show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history. And now, the news.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Wow, there is a lot of cool stuff at Discovery World. Where am I going to tell the listener all about this good stuff?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, and sci-fi. If you're new to Technorama, welcome and thank you. If you're a returning listener, we appreciate you giving us your time once again. My name is Chuck Tomasi, and this time I've got another special show for you. My daughter Lisa, co-worker WL from Malaysia, and I headed down to Pier, Wisconsin, just outside of Milwaukee, where we were given a tour of the Discovery World by our host Chuck Ahman. Discovery World at Pier, Wisconsin is a complex and innovative concept that connects the natural world with the human design technology. They offer a large variety of education, cultural, and environmental programs for visitors of all ages. These programs include hands-on exhibits, freshwater and saltwater aquariums, interactive educational programs, state-of-the-art media and distance learning labs, digital theaters, and live performance theater. Discovery World also offers volunteer lifelong learning opportunities. So join us and listen to our audio tour of Discovery World at Pier, Wisconsin. We're here at Pier, Wisconsin with Chuck Ahman, Director of Technology. How are you, Chuck?
I'm doing fine today. How about you?
Wonderful. Now, Chuck, this is an impressive-looking building. Looking around, I see a Segway scooter. I see a solar-powered car. This is the just off the lobby, correct?
It is. It's right off what we call our main promenade. As you enter the building, we actually have two buildings as a complex that stick out over Lake Michigan. As you walk through the front doors, you're met with a long wood deck that runs the entire length of both buildings. Both buildings are connected. And as you walk in the front door, as you look forward, you can see almost an entire block right through the buildings to Lake Michigan.
It's beautiful. The water is right there. We saw a sailboat go by like 30 feet from the building. It was gorgeous. Now, how would you categorize or classify Discovery World?
Well, really what we're what we are is we're a place for adults, the community, older children to come down, take a look at technology and how it interacts with them in their daily life, some of the newer technology, and we interlace that with how it relates to the natural world. And what I mean by that is, of course, we're located right on the shore of Lake Michigan, actually literally in Lake Michigan. And a lot of people haven't had that relationship with the lake, although they've seen it, they look out there. They may have never been on the lake or near the lake. So we mix how the natural environment and science come together. And we try to get kids and adults interested in the different kinds of things that are going around in their surroundings.
Oh, sounds like Technorama material to me.
Geeksville.
Yeah. So where would you like to start?
Where would you like to start? We've got quite a trip going here. So right now we're in the lower exhibit hall, which is right in the west side of the building. And right behind you is the what we call the Rockwell Dream Machine. And this exhibit has actually been put in by Rockwell Automation. And if we'd like to walk over there, we can take a look at it. But it shows kids and adults just how they can manufacture different items, what it takes, automatic controls, the processes, and the kind of machines and gizmos that can come together to actually produce this automation. Why don't we go
over there? Yeah, let's take a look. And we have to give a little disclaimer. We're not taking the standard tour with this. Chuck is the director of information technology, and we're going to take a little peek behind the scenes, sort of a man behind the curtain look at some of the way things go.
So what you actually see here is Lyon Bradley. He actually, through infrared sensors up there, can actually pick up your daughter. Actually, Chuck is standing in front of it, and he can actually tell where she is and turns his head to watch him. and she's talking to him. Now, if she were to scamper off on him, he actually makes a comment such as, you know, where are you going? You could have said goodbye. So it's an interactive exhibit. Lyon Bradley actually was one of the founders of Allen Bradley, which became Rockwell Automation through merger. And again, right, he's describing what the machines behind him here are doing.
And I see all kinds of what would appear to be kind of manufacturing type of conveyors and levers and robotics going up and down. The machine in the cabinet over there is what a...
That's an actual CNC machine.
I was going to say, it looks like a CNC milling machine.
The kids put a block into it, and it CNCs out a product for them. We actually have four CNC machines in the building. As we get through the tour, we've got three other ones in the lab area. So we do have it so that young adults and adults can actually work with CAD and design and then produce whatever it is that they've actually dreamt up or imagined. And some of the other parts to the Rockwell Dream Machine here are there's a dragonfly that can be manufactured, a couple of boats. We have the Dennis Sullivan, which we own and operate. The SV Dennis Sullivan is a three-masted wooden tall ship. So they can get a replica of that here through the Dream Machine. And then a Challenge, which is our second wooden tall ship that we built. It doesn't sail, but it's actually part of a spectacular view you'll see in the second building when we get there.
Excellent. Now, I have to ask, what is your responsibility for a display like this? Where do you come in?
Well, we help keep it maintained and, you know, network connectivity to it because Rockwell actually maintains a lot of this machine. Mm-hmm. It took quite a few of their engineers to design and build it. It's, as you can see, a spectacular machine. It's about, what would you say, about 30 feet in diameter. Yeah. The kids walk around it. There's different interactive displays which allows them to pick and decide what they want to build or manufacture. And around the outside edge, you can see we have replicas of the Miller Park roof here in Wisconsin.
That's what that is.
Yep, and so it shows the automation and how it's automated to open the roof. And on the other side, what they call the Breez Soleil here in Milwaukee, we have the Milwaukee Art Museum right next door to us here on the lakefront. And it's an incredible roof that opens up like a wing. And both of those show the automation that's involved in just watching the wind loads and opening and closing of something like that. And over here you have a traffic light where kids actually rewire it.
My daughter's currently playing with the traffic light, and we may have a hard time getting her out of here.
Yep, kids get right into it, which is exactly what you're looking for. What we're hoping is when kids walk away, whether it's in chemistry, biology, the manufacturing processes, science, technology, you know, that they just find an interest or something that clicks in their mind that wants them to delve in further and investigate what they're interested in, what they want to do in life, and open up their imagination to different kinds of things that are out there.
Oh, this is terrific. All right, let's move on to the next stop. We've come to the Hoberman Genome Display, and there is a huge double helix of what appears to be DNA, and it's hooked up with a motor and cables and pulleys, and it's actually retracting and expanding kind of slowly, but it is perceptible change. This is beautiful. Where did this come from?
Well, this right here is actually an original Chuck Hoberman design. Chuck Hoberman, if you've ever seen the plastic balls that you need to pull out and expand to, you know,
and
he zipped down into something. So, well, he patented, and he does the math on that. And what he's done here is designed this just for Discovery World. And what you're looking at is this piece sits right in the middle of a double helix staircase.
There are two, aren't there?
Yes, there are. A double helical staircase, and then it's a double helical design, which goes all the way down to about 3.5 feet, and when it's fully open, is about 37 feet. So it moves, it's lit real well, and as it changes colors and speeds, you'll see it pick up and close throughout the day quite a bit.
It almost looks like one of those retractable arms when, you know, with the crisscross patterns, you pull the lever and it reaches out 10 feet, grabs something and comes back like you see on the cartoons. Only if you put about 1,000 of those together in a spiral pattern, you kind of have a picture of what this thing looks like on a pole.
Yeah, in just a couple moments, you'll see that it compresses itself down. It'll only be about 3.5 feet, and it'll take off, and it'll expand from, well, this is about 4 floors, so it's 37 feet tall when it's wide open and staircase to staircase. And I've always said I think one of the most impressive design features of this is as it expands all the way out to the staircases, you'll see how it twists in such a way that the kids can't reach it from the staircase.
Very creative. That takes talent. Wow, I just can't imagine the math that goes into designing something like this. It looks like at any point it could easily get jammed if any one of those hinges didn't work quite right.
Actually, there's no pressure on them at all, and that's the art of the whole thing. It expands and contracts. It's very balanced, and so without the cables, you know, we've seen their technicians just ride it up and pull it apart. So it's actually very smooth movements in it. I believe there's over 8,000 joints, and it's machined aluminum.
Geek art at its finest. We'll have to put a picture of that on the webpage. All right, let's keep going up this double helical stairs. We've come to the top of the stairs, and I've got all kinds of strange metallic trees as surroundings. We've got... must have what appears to be a car. What are we looking at?
Well, actually, you're in the techno jungle right now.
Ah.
And everybody here is on safari. We're looking for the next great idea.
Okay.
All right, so that's what you hunt out in this area. Right here, what you're looking at is actually by Johnson Controls. And it's a prototype vehicle. And it shows the different controls that can be put into a vehicle to adjust different things, everything from heat and air conditioning to the radios. So as you look through it, you're going to see a lot of different functionality that we see in a car today and some of the functionality we're going to see in the future. Of course, just in the last 5 or 6 years, we know that one of the great innovations for parents is to have a VCR in the van, right?
Yes.
Throw on the headphones and put brother or sister in the back. And so these type of innovations in a small, lightweight car, and you can see the digital inputs and things, screens that you can actually program your car and how it's running and maintain fuel efficiency. All those things, again, come into the type of thing that Johnson Controls here in Milwaukee designs and builds to maintain control of environmental systems and building systems.
Very interesting. It's kind of an Art Deco car. At first glance, it looks like a Scion, but it's got some interesting things in here for a prototype that you wouldn't see. For example, what appears to be a big LCD sticking out of the dashboard on an arm. Hi, I'm Chuck.
Hi, Chuck. How you doing?
Who are you?
Earhart. I show off the Johnson Controls exhibit here.
Give us the lowdown on this. We're doing an internet radio show, a podcast.
Nice.
On science and technology. Have we hit the jackpot?
Oh, yeah, you hit the jackpot.
All right.
This is a lot of stuff to this exhibit. They're just showing off some of the stuff that they're test marketing out on the market right now. One of those things is a webcam in your car, because they figured the cars are going to be hooked up to the internet in about 5 or 6 years. High-speed wireless internet when you cruise around from border to border. So they figured as long as it's already on the internet and the engine is already talking to the manufacturer and to your mechanic, you know, giving status reports, might as well put a webcam in there to, I guess you can talk to somebody halfway around the world and they can see you through the webcam.
My partner over here is from halfway around the world.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I could talk to my sister. She's in South Korea. Well, hopefully you wouldn't be watching them. They'd just be watching you because you're supposed to be watching the road. That's the whole point.
Gotcha.
A lot of people raise up problems with that. They start getting a little nervous when I start mentioning the webcam and the touchscreen control. The touchscreen control here has access to the internet because everything else, you know, has internet already, and it gives you all the control of everything in your car except for driving. Everything that's normally on the dashboard is now in the touchscreen control, and that gives you the light, the heat, internet, radio, TV, anything you want. Even the GPS is in the touchscreen control.
Would that include speedometer, odometer, oil pressure, that kind of thing, or is that still in a standard gauge or display format?
Yeah, that would include all of the non-essential driving information, stuff that you don't right away need. All the essential driving information like speed and gas and warning lights, they're in one simplified little disc right inside the steering wheel gauge. So instead of having like four different gauges, you have just one.
Does the car talk to you?
No, they didn't mention anything about that in the exhibit. But
ding! You are out of gas.
It probably would. Probably would. One of these years, they'll have something like that. Feel free to conjecture about the stuff they'll have 5 or 10 years from now, because it's all coming together so fast. Hey, you're more likely to be right. If you say it's going to have internet, it's going to have internet. If you say it's going to be able to access your music from home over your car, over the internet, it could do that too. Your MP3s at home stored on your computer could probably transmit over the internet to your car. So you could probably listen to the files that you have at home through your car. I'm just guessing, but yeah, that could be done.
Technorama on the road. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Here at the Center of Podcast Studies, we know the dangers of podcasting and what you should avoid. Here's a sample.
All right, it works.
Yes, I got it back. I got every bit of it.
It's small, fast, does hex and block edits. But
oh, that's a good idea. I didn't think about that last time.
We're your geek morning show.
That's the thing about podcasts. We can be up anytime.
Don't listen to this while operating heavy machinery. You could spit out your water. I wonder what you'd get. Okay, I'm going to stop right there and make my comment.
Hey, wake me up when you're done.
I completely missed that one.
The writers of Back to the Future didn't see that one coming. Thanks, man. I had to think about that.
For your own research materials, visit chuckchat.com/technorama. Protect yourself.
Around the world, everyone's opening the bathroom doors to expose the...
Wash your hands before every email.
Yeah, Chuck DeMossi's the devil. I like it. Okay, it just feels tacked on. Have you used it, Chuck?
I'm weird. Sorry.
Go.
Craig, I heard that. You were taking a drink and almost lost it. I'm going to get you sooner or later. We're going to hear him all over the microphone.
You're right.
Chuck, you owe me a new microphone. Did I ask for this?
Okay, we moved on from the car of tomorrow, as I'll call it. And we have what appears to be a little battle bot ring, only they're not battling. They've got the child's donut toy, the Fisher-Price, where they have the colored donuts that stack up. Probably 15 or 20 of the sets of them. And the robot is... The robot just went missing. Where'd it go? What else have we got? We've got marbles in a circle.
Well, it's actually a challenge course for robots. And we have high schools around the area that actually have a challenge program that they build. The students in the high schools come in every week and they have a different challenge. But additionally, here on the exhibit floor, we have the same thing for kids to understand and see how robots work. Of course, you know, some of the most famous robots that we have gone on now for, what, almost 4 years?
Yeah. This is a mini first competition, isn't it?
Yeah, literally.
I see a first contender over there. First is for inspiration of science and research, robotic science and technology. Dean Kamen is the kind of the lead on that, the person who spends all the money to get it going, to inspire kids to... look at different career opportunities than high-tech sports, or to look at technology and science. So I recognize that robot because our company helps sponsor the high school kids as well.
Uh-huh.
And now it's starting to make sense. This is a little first ring.
Exactly what it is. And so what happens is it's here to show kids how you can build small models and robotics, and then the challenges that come up, lifting the rings and putting them on their posts. Again, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a marble pond in the middle, which makes traction very difficult.
Oh, I guess.
And so by designing your robot appropriately, hopefully you'll get through the challenge just fine or faster than the other guys. So
now let's go over to the workbench and see what these guys are up to. They look like high school kids playing with the erector set and robotics parts. And hi, guys.
Hi.
My name's Chuck. I do a podcast.
I am Dustin.
You're going to be on the internet soon. What, can you tell me what you're building and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, what we're building is these are Vex robots, and you can buy them at Radio Shack. And we're trying to build these robots for a challenge, which is called King of the Rings. And you have to take the rings and stack it onto one of the child's toys that has a different color rings. They're different sizes. And the smaller the ring, the more point values. And the whole point of the game is to get the most points.
So this one is your robot? You've built this personally?
Yes.
And what is your strategy with this? I see rubber bands and wheels and gears and levers and things. Tell me a little bit about what you expect to accomplish with this.
Well, we have the rubber bands surrounding some little axles that will tension the rings when they're held on, and the rubber will give it the friction needed to be able to stay in place. And we have a nice gearbox that has a low to high ratio, so it will be able to grab things. And then we have our arm, which moves up and down, and we have a two-wheel drive.
Okay, and you seem to have a, what, different strategy or similar strategy?
It's similar, except in our chassis, we have a four-wheel drive, and we have what is known as an A-frame, meaning that it's shaped like an A, and you can drive over just about anything. It's like the Humvee of robots.
So you got better traction when you get into, like, the marble pond?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Now, at the heart of this, I see a silver box with wires and things coming out. Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, it's pretty much the heart of the robot. You plug in all your motors to it, and then you program it through that box.
How much is programming, and how much is RF controlled from the handset?
What do you mean? Could you?
Well, I see what looks like one of those, you know, RC controlled airplane things with joysticks on it, but yet you've got programming capabilities in this box?
Yeah, you do. And mainly you program it through the controller, but there are programs you can use, go on a computer and add different functions to it.
Oh, terrific. Have you had them out on the floor?
Yeah, we have, but
who's winning?
We're pretty even, actually.
You just come here on the weekends to debug your projects?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, guys, it's been great talking with you.
Yeah.
Thank you, and good luck. What have we got here?
It's a vein viewer. They use infrared lights and a digital camera.
It almost looks like an X-ray machine, only it's shining a green light onto her hand. So if I want to find my vein... Oh, my gosh.
It's a lot safer than an X-ray.
And I know from donating blood, there is one right there.
Daddy, that's...
Holy cow, and you look in your hand. Now, the thing I want to try... Lisa, you remember this trick? Hold the microphone for a second. Right there. There's a neat trick. We have one of these at work?
Yeah,
really?
Because when we did the ring out.
Does it know how to find the vein if the vein is blocked? Oh, look at that.
And you can tell by... Do you see the words around it?
The words around it say...
So when you can read them, that's when you know it's in focus.
Luminex. Oh, okay. Gotcha. So if it's too high or too low, there is a focus to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually see the veins pulsing.
Mm-hmm. And if you go on your wrist?
And what I did is, veins have little valves in them. So I blocked one off and purged it so it was up to the valve. And then when you let the blood flow through, you can actually...
Yep.
Isn't that cool?
Sometimes you see it pulses. You see a little bit of pulsing.
You can see the whole network of veins and things going through.
Yeah.
And it's all infrared.
Infrared and
so
digital
it's bouncing. Oh, and then it just projects the image back.
Yep. So it's a lot safer than an X-ray machine.
The hair kind of screws up the shadows,
yeah.
But...
That's
look at that, the backside of your wrist. Where's the focus? Right there.
Daddy,
that is really neat. It's green image of veins with Look at, oh, I can see right through Lisa's arm. Isn't that neat?
Yeah, that's a big one right there.
Lisa, let's look at your neck.
We can actually look at her neck. If put your neck like this.
Look, you can see.
Let's see if I can get it in.
Oh, it looks like a horror film.
Get in there, focus.
Say something.
That's neat. I hear thunder and lightning. What is this display, Chuck?
This is actually my favorite. I don't know what it is about it, but there's something about being able to create your own thunderstorm that just you get a kick out of it.
You get to play God.
What you're looking at is a large screen TV in front of you showing Discovery World out here on Lake Michigan Shore, here, Wisconsin. And, of course, your perspective is out in the lake a few feet. And down in front of you, you have a touch screen, an aerial view of Milwaukee. And what you can do is you just tap on the screen wherever you like, and if it's in the distance, you'll see a light flash, and then you're watching the sound wave actually travel to the point where you're standing on the diagram. So this shows the relationship between a bolt of lightning coming down and how long that sound takes to get to you where you're standing watching. Now, in addition to that, one of the nice things about it is kids can find out how many seconds it takes to get that sound to you. Mm-hmm. You see the shock wave, and it's in surround sound. Check it out.
All right.
There it comes.
Look at the display. Yep. Now, what is there's a gauge on the bottom of here, minimum charge, maximum charge. What is that indicating?
Well, right now, depending on how many clouds there are in the sky, if all of these lightning bolts come out of the same cloud, then there's going to be a lot less charge. So you have to wait for the charge to get back up before the lightning can strike again.
Okay, so it's sort of a potential of what could happen, how much energy is in the clouds. It's almost like playing one of those adventure games where you've got so much life force.
Yes, exactly.
One, two, and when you touch the screen, it starts counting seconds from the time you touch it. You know, sound really doesn't move that quickly, does it, Lisa? Okay, so I'm going to launch one about three.
Have you seen a lightning?
And you can see the lightning on the screen if you put it in front of the camera. Wow. Chuck wants to touch the building.
Here you go.
Oh, that was loud.
You could almost feel that one. Lisa touched the camera. You just fried the spectator.
Dad's cool.
She knocked out the camera. You need a new display. That is really interesting. What a great way to teach them.
That was actually designed by students at MATC, Milwaukee Area Technical College. And they've got many other items that they're working on. But through a partnership with Discovery World and METC, this is some of the things that they're putting together and learning about virtual programming and that kind of setup. So this is a great display.
They did an awesome job because on the big flat panel screen, the clouds are moving. I mean, you'd swear this was a real storm.
If everybody were to step away from this exhibit for just about 1 minute, the sky's actually clear, and it's a nice blue sky. And as you walk up, it senses that somebody's gotten close, and you start seeing it turn gray, and the clouds start forming.
Oh, no kidding.
Yep.
Storm on demand. What's next?
And this one doesn't have to keep you up at night.
That's great. I love it. I should just stand here and get audio effects for the rest of the show. Need a thunderstorm? Make your own. All right, we've left the thunderstorm. Now we are looking at what?
I'm not.
No idea. We're winging it. We're looking at a man programming.
This is send an e-card to your friend.
Oh, okay.
But it's a virtual.
Oh, I see. You could take a
Right here.
Hi, I'm Chuck.
Oh, I'm Andrea.
I do a podcast called Technorama about science and technology.
Okay.
Chuck here was kind enough to show us around, and we came across your exhibit. What can you tell me about it?
Well, this is a live photo exhibit that we are running for a short period of time, a couple of months. What we do is pretty much try to have a variety of age group show different like empowerment, give people confidence and imagination. We select four different personalities that people can pick from every weekend, and we have like a poster board that shows these four different personalities, which have different people like pose. There's like cloud engineering is one of them, which does include a prop. Sometimes there's other ones that have like a bird that will be implanted on Photoshop on your finger, so it gives people that imagination of like, you know, like, oh, I'm gonna do this with my life. The whole exhibit is called I Run the World, and I Run the World is supposed to just, you know, enforce that confidence, creativeness and empowerment overall. So I don't know if that explains anything, but we do all the Photoshop here, and then after we photograph, we put it in a slideshow. It gets put on the wall all day. It goes through the whole slide of all the pictures that we took, and then it also gets sent to you in an e-card, so you have a memory or souvenir of your day at Discovery.
We've stepped into a much quieter area. It's labeled the Electronics Lab.
Correct. Yes, we're in our lab spaces now. We have six labs here, large classroom environments that are set up for the particular sciences. You're standing, as you said, in the electronics lab, and here in front of you, you have about 20 high-end PCs with LCD displays, and of course, right next to them, you can see you have soldering irons and all the materials needed to design something like those robots and electrical circuits. The students can come in here and actually design their circuits on software, test them for voltage and any problems. Oh. And after they create their circuits and design them, they can actually manufacture them here on the workbenches. So we have a teacher station here, lab station, and we have schools that come through on a daily basis during the week. And then on the weekends, you'll notice that we have large open-end garage doors we roll up, and this becomes more of a general public walkthrough for shorter type of labs. And as you look through the glass walls, the labs all have glass walls to the other labs. The very end one is a biology lab. That's where we have all our microscopes. We can search for what we call critters in the Great Lakes environment, so the kids test the water. The one next to us we call the General Science Lab. It's a double-wide lab. And they're doing a particular, we've done forensics. Kids come in and have done forensic science. That's a big thing now. Learning how to tell fingerprints or how something came about by just breaking down the situation and extrapolating, you know, a hypothesis. Over here, we've got a rapid prototyping lab. There's a class going on there right now. And of course, this is early October, so what they're doing for the public is they're actually making and designing and they're prototyping some really wild Halloween trick-or-treat bags. So I think they've got a couple of them, a couple of ghosts and things, but they actually have to manufacture the bags while they're here. But inside there, we have another 20 machines where the students would actually design in CAD or SolidWorks, and as you can see through the glass, there's three more CNC machines in that lab. We have three laser cutters. We have a rapid prototyping machine. I don't know if you're familiar with one of those.
Oh, yeah. We have mechanical engineers where I work.
This is great. You know, the IT department has waited a long time for a rapid prototyper because one of my coworkers, Paul Hayden, who really should be credited with building out these labs and coming up with them, Paul Hayden couldn't wait to get a hold of that because he's building it as R2-D2 at home. And, of course, it's very hard, as all of us geeks know, to get some of those parts machined. He can actually CAD them out and manufacture them right here on site. So it's working well for the R2-D2 model. I think we have an air vent that we made for him that was difficult. Additionally, we have laser cutters, box cutters, and the kids... Students can actually learn how to design furniture, and they cut it out and actually can make chairs out of it.
Wow, what a tremendous experience and gain exposure to that industry. I mean, get people interested in becoming a mechanical engineer or textile engineer or, you know, electrical engineer. Just a great way to start them off. I mean, I had no clue about a lot of this stuff until I was late into high school and even early college. And these technologies weren't around. I mean, there were no rapid prototyping things that I knew of in the early 80s or late 70s. If they were, they didn't look anything like that.
And absolutely, and that's the thing. Not just to put people in front of the machines and say, look at what they can do, but to get them to see how you program them and how they are run and what it takes. You know, when we always had that lecture going on, you know, you're going to need math when you're older,
right.
You know, and we were always
right.
Like, nah,
yeah,
what for, you know.
I'm not building any bridges. Now you can.
Exactly. And here you can. You could actually design it. You could design a bridge and actually print it out in that lab. The lab past that is our printing and publishing lab. And you can, they all have, again, about 20 to 25 PCs, high-end, with touch tablets, so you can draw, you can animate, and we can print on quite a few different materials. We have a silk screen process in there, which you can silk screen your own pieces and make quite a few different objects. I think right now for the public, they're doing lanterns, which mm-hmm. are quite interesting. Silk screen lanterns. Trying to remember the other printing processes in there, but we have four or five different printing processes right in that lab.
Wow.
And the one past that I'm going to show you in just a couple minutes.
Okay, we'll give the listener a break and we'll head over there. All right, we've come up to a display that says Saturday TV Studio Tours and Make a Podcast to Take Home on a CD. Now, they're teaching classes on podcasting.
Yes, actually, I'm thinking that you might want to step in and get some pointers and some tips on this and see if it's something you'd like to go into, Chuck.
I think I have a fascination with this. It might be fun to try.
It absolutely is. And we'll take you into those studios right now.
Wonderful.
We get behind the scenes with the man with the key card. We're standing in the control room. Audio and visual. This is what we came for, I think. We've got a big mixer off to our right. Looks like about 20 channels. 14, 18, 16, something like that. An AV mixer in front of us. And a screen with a grid full of displays. Now, there appears to be multiple camera angles, and then they're superimposing a different background. There's several people out there. What do we got? 20 people standing in front of a green screen, and then they can put any background they want on them.
Of course, it's a roof party. Chuck, can't you tell?
Oh, I haven't been to a roof party lately.
Well, we've got about 15, 20 people out on the roof of the, that's the Wisconsin Gas Company building.
Ah!
Anybody that lives in Milwaukee would recognize the flame on the top, right behind
the big
them.
Blue lantern. Yep.
Exactly. What you're standing in here is actually the control booth to our TV studio here at Discovery World. It's an all high def TV studio, and so it's one of the best studios you're going to find in the Midwest. Along with that, we have a virtual set. That's the green screen. As you look out at the people through the windows, actually, we're just seeing them in front of a full head-to-toe, wall-to-wall green area.
Yeah.
But inside on the monitors, we have CG generating rooftop views from three different camera angles. So we can actually fly in on these people, zoom left and right, and they all look appropriately placed on the side of the building.
They now, do. There's a wall in the foreground that's actually blocking the children. You know, they could actually duck behind that wall. Now, one of these angles is a little screwy because the guy is standing off in space. But
well, you know, you have to be careful they don't jump. And that's actually what this screen down here, as you see, it's labeled Server 1.
Uh-huh.
You see this picture of the side of the building. And if any of the kids were to jump over the side, they flail their arms and they would obviously be going down. They never reach the bottom. Don't worry, folks. It's all virtual, but kids can experience that. Matter of fact, you're probably seeing some of them practicing right now for their big quantum leap here. But the point is that it's not just a virtual set, but it's multi multi-camera view virtual set.
Yeah.
We also switch this out, and we bring classes and schools in here, and they learn how to write their own new scripts. They learn how to do the CG. They have to run the whole system.
Awesome.
And then that group will put it together with a news desk, a sports desk, weather, and they assemble that into a small newscast, and then they walk away actually with a DVD of the experience, learning to program the teleprompters, and all the systems. They do their own directing and the whole works.
Again, another great introduction to, you know, potential career moves for these kids.
Yes, it is. Actually, and we've got one guy there. He's on the edge, man. Somebody talk him back. Talk him back.
Jump. Go for it.
They're out there. They know where they are. They have monitors that they're looking at. They can place themselves on the roof.
Now, behind us, what have we got? I hear servers and fans. This sounds very familiar from an audio standpoint, but looking at it first head on, there's quite a few things in here that I'm not used to. What have we got in the rack?
Well, of course, the most important thing is lots of blinky lights.
That's the best kind.
You know, if there are more blue ones, though. We like blue ones here, but mostly green and red. This is an Avid media server.
Okay.
Along with, I'm trying to remember the names of some of these companies here, the Grass Valley. So we have a Grass Valley system. Because we're doing everything in high def, it's all digital.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's on tape, so everything's being trapped onto the servers, and then at very high bandwidth rates between the servers and the editing computers, they need that to actually be able to edit everything. Now, we're editing in high def again, so that's all done in Adobe Final Cut Pro.
Right.
And using After Effects. So we actually have the capability here at Discovery World of shooting everything in high def, fully editing things end-to-end in high definition. And again, a little later in the program, I'm going to show you the very first and only high-definition theaters in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, looking forward to that. What sort of, just for the geeks that are listening, what sort of connectivity? You mentioned high-speed connection between the servers and things. Give us some behind-the-scenes technicals.
Well, looking at the infrastructure building, let's just sort of build up with that. We have two buildings that we actually have on the campus. They're linked by a small connector area, but the distance is much too far to run any kind of Cat 5 or, in this day and age, Cat 6. So the building's been heavily designed and wired. We actually put in, Paul and I designed this, we put fiber between the buildings and vertically through all the floors. So the only place that copper radiates out in Cat 6 is on each floor.
Okay.
So it's all fiber backbone, all gigabit. And the labs, as you saw, we're in with all those computers, we actually fiber. We have a rack and a switch in each one of those to handle the computers in each one.
Nice.
And so we're gig all the way up to that. So we're pretty much a gig through the whole building. And then we have some separate video. What we did was we actually took, and when we designed it, because we were going to parse video through the building in a lot of different ways, whether it be audio, video streaming, you're going to see in the theaters that we're able to go live from one theater to another. And plug in, and because of that kind of bandwidth that you're going to use, obviously we all know if you throw that on your data network, you're just asking for problems.
Yep.
So we designed the building so we can pick up any pairs of fiber we want and transfer them over to the video side and segregate video from data within the complex, and then just move them left or right if we want to move them back from video to data. And that's how we designed the infrastructure of the building.
When was the building built?
The building is just being wrapped up, actually. I mean, we built it over the last 3 years and moved in just before June.
Oh, that's right. We were trying to get together, but we wanted to wait until things got nailed down here first.
Right, yep. We were all kind of running around just, you know, putting all the final connections. Of course, it'll take us a couple of months still to plug in everything. You've got something this large, you're just amazed at how many times you have to plug something in during the day.
It's impressive. This is very spectacular.
To burn up a label maker and a heartbeat in this place with cable right now. But rule number one, never, ever forget the label.
No, that's imperative around here. Actually, anywhere it is. I even do that in my studio. All right, we'll move on. I see you, Mac. Now, where have we landed?
We've landed dead center in the control room of the Audio Labs.
Oh, I see some familiar equipment in here. I see a... Is that a new Mac Pro?
It's a G5.
That's a G5. Yeah. Oh, you're so 2006.
Right. This is the program we're using right here is Pro Tools, and we're doing an interactive audio experience with field recordings and voiceovers.
All right. I also see the M-Audio keyboard down there. I've got a 61. There's a 48.
Let's watch one hand.
Let's. So what are you working on right now?
Right now we have, excuse me, we have different tracks. We have our voice track that we're going to record. And then we have our background track, which is consisting of a beat of bees that we recorded at a bee farm. And there's two people in the studio, and they're going to be doing our voiceover work. So they can probably hear us now, right? Okay.
These are Shure SM7Bs, Adam Curry style.
That's right. So,
and what will they be recording?
They will be recording off of... They'll be recording their voices off of a script that we wrote for the interactive bee experience.
I love it. I get into this because we do the same thing every week for our introduction. We have to have a lot of imagination.
So I'm going to play this for you, and you're just going to practice reading the script with the audio in the background. And there will be a countdown, 3, 2, 1, and then you can start reading.
All right, where are you leading us?
All right, well, we just left the Audio Labs, and of course, Chuck Oz turns the microphone off when he, you know, oogles one of the G5s. But, of course, after leaving the television and Audio Labs, after you shoot all that, what do you need to do to it?
You need to edit it.
Well, let's go check that off.
We go into the editing computer lab, and I see...
They say oodles and oodles.
Oodles and oodles
of
Mac G5s.
Again, yes, this is an editing classroom. And all the, as we're looking across, we see four rows of Mac G5s. Every student with a 20-inch LCD panel next to their 17-inch LCD panel. So dual LCDs on each one. Then they have the DV decks and recorders. And they all have lacy external hard drives. Nice. There's some real rationale behind that. Can you imagine holding a class where all of these students were editing their high-definition production or even a DV production? And the teacher at the end of the evening says, all right, everybody, I want you to save your work now.
Back to the network.
That... You just don't overcome something like that. So
nope.
Given that, and because a lot of students would want or need to walk off with their production, work on it somewhere else, we put in the lacy removable hard drives. Now, this room does actually have fiber coming in, so that can support transfers from the TV studio in here at rapid speeds, and they can load it onto the servers and work off of there. But when you've got 20, 25 students actually doing video, clicking the save button probably bury us. So,
and is it Final Cut in here again?
Again, yep. They're fully rigged with the Final Cut Pro, high definition, capable, and also Adobe After Effects.
Are you a Mac person or a Windows person?
All right, the secret's out. Hopefully I don't have a lot of people that know me out there, but I have both.
He goes both ways. Good man.
I go both ways. I do have a Mac, and I do have a PC at home. And, you know, I'm quite proud being an IBM guy that when I get the Mac doing something I haven't for a while, you know, I got it to tunnel into the network. So I was pretty proud to get that through a Sonic wall. Need help, call.
We call that using the right tool for the right job.
That's how I justify it.
And in all actuality, there's absolutely no question that you, if you're into the graphics and the video editing, you definitely want to pick up your Mac, yep. Mac G5. Yep. And if you're in the business applications, you know, stick with your PC-based.
You mean if you're stuck on Microsoft Exchange?
Well, it's that or you try to get the Entourage to do some of the things it still doesn't do. Anybody that's working with Entourage, it still doesn't do the group calendars very well. We're wrestling through that. So,
or as we call it, rage.
Yeah, we're a mixed environment here. So we have our entire team of creative people are working on Macs on our network. And, of course, then we have the PC base. So we've had to support both, and we're getting pretty darn good at finding where one or the other is beneficial or has some drawbacks.
Excellent.
Chuck, tell us where you've led us.
I've taken you to the top.
We are at the top.
The top of the Aquatarium building, and we call this the Pilot House. It's a 360-degree round room, all glass, and it's got an incredible vista of Milwaukee, the shoreline to the north and south, and, of course, Lake Michigan, which the building is actually over Lake Michigan. If you were to look under the building right now, you'd see the water flowing.
Wow.
Right down in front of us, we're looking down on the lakefront, and we have a dock that supports our sailing vessel, Dennis Sullivan. It's a 137-foot, three-masted, solid wood Great Lake schooner.
Where is it?
It's actually headed south for the winter.
Oh.
The water here up in Wisconsin gets thick, and it's rough on boats, so... they're right now working their way through the St. Lawrence Seaway. This is, again, the first week of October. And they're just heading through the St. Lawrence Seaway on their way up past Nova Scotia and then down the East Coast for their winter. You could call it a winter home, but they actually sail in the Bahamas and take school kids on 14-day journeys around some of the research islands.
Neat.
An interesting thing about it is that the kids aren't allowed to bring iPods, they can't bring their cell phones, there's no radios. And when they get down there, parents, you don't even have to give them a buck for their pocket because there's no way they could spend it. They spend 6 days out on the open ocean doing water research and science and standing watch and sailing to Dennis Sullivan day and night. And they get out to a small island called Lee Stocking, which is a NOAA research facility. It has about 7 to 10 NOAA researchers on it, and they spend a day and a half with the NOAA researchers. And then, of course, they get back on to Dennis Sullivan off this little island, and they sail for another 6 days back to Miami or West Palm Beach, wherever we departed from. And it's a great experience for the kids. They learn very quickly how to become more independent, that they need to be responsible for the navigation and the safety of the ship, along with doing their studies on history, water quality, you know, the differences between salt water and fresh water.
Excellent. That's terrific. Now, we can see in the background, well, actually in the foreground, is that the art museum?
Yep, that's the Calatrava addition to the Milwaukee Art Museum. A lot of people recognize that. It's on a lot of national advertisements and everything else it has. Again, I mentioned it earlier, the Breeze Soleil, which is the wings of the building, which open up during the day and create, like, it looks as though a bird is taking off from the lakefront.
Yeah.
And that's the same exhibit we saw in their very first segment, where the Breeze Soleil Rockwell Automation has shown how they can automate the opening and closing of that roof and how they have to watch the wind speeds and the air flows to, you know, maintain that look.
And then just out in front of us, we've got dozens of sailboats cruising around. I mean, it's beautiful up here.
The pink guy, the guy with the pink one, he went up in the air and then he fell in.
he's sail surfing. He's using the sail to pull his surfboard around, but he's off the board right now.
I think he fell in because he went up in the air and then he fell in.
He came off his board. And the pier out here almost reminds me of San Francisco. It's a nice wooden dock, but instead of sea lions, we've got ducks.
Yes, and actually we have a stage area down here. Again, the sailboat would be here in the evenings during the summer, and then we have small groups that come in, and it's always open to the public. This is just a walking lakefront area, so people come down, sit down, put their feet up, and listen to a little folk music. in the summer evenings. It's quite enjoyable to watch the sun go down over the lake.
Are you cool?
And the weather is starting to turn cool, so I don't suspect we have too many people here now.
Well, you'd be real surprised. I mean, not maybe on our dock, but you'll see a lot of people walking the area. And, of course, you said, you know, dozens, I would say literally dozens of sailboats out in front of us. And they're trying to get their last sails in. Of course, it's much windier in September and October, so they're out
That's
there
true.
Under full sail and having a grand old time.
This is sailing weather. It's probably about 68 degrees Fahrenheit, and I wouldn't be able to estimate the breeze, but I'd have to say it's probably around 15, 20 knots.
And you're looking out this way. You can see our building is literally out over Lake Michigan. We're up about 6 stories above the water, and of course with this grand vista, you can actually see the Great Lakes ships. There's a Laker, as we call them here, heading out of the Milwaukee breakwater with concrete.
Amazing. We saw another one as we were coming in, similar, only it was a little different color. But yeah, that's a regular occurrence here?
Absolutely. A lot of grain moving this time of year, and a lot of ships coming and going out of the Great Lakes port now. Given the change in fuel costs and everything else, a lot of things are starting to move by ship again. Down in front of us, we have Lakeshore State Park, Wisconsin's newest state park. They're going to have that finished literally in the next few weeks. You can see there's a bridge coming off of the Summerfest grounds that you can walk over there. They'll have docks in case next summer you want to come out and you're a sailor or a boater. You can boat right up and dock your boat at the state park and go visit.
You said newest. It looks like it's still in land reclamation mode. There's boulders around the shoreline and several heavy trucks still moving gravel and things around. But if it's weeks away, they've got a bit of a job ahead of them.
You'd be amazed at how much they can move with these barges. And you'll
That's
see,
true.
If you look out, you'll see a couple moored barges with large rock on it that the cranes will drop in around the island to protect it from erosion.
Okay. Wow, Lisa, look at all the seagulls that are out there fluttering around. It looks like snow. Steve Pruitt from MotoCast.
I'm Chuck's towel boy.
If we finish this in one take, it'll be amazing.
Are you right much, Chuck?
Hey, kids, pigs can fly.
Yeah.
I got a free laptop.
Preach on. Yeah, Vista's coming out this year.
Oh, you're not invited back. No showing up the host.
Well, keep your boss happy.
Yeah, keep him up.
Trust me.
As we get more lightning, flash, flash, flash.
Kind of not funny.
No, sorry.
Ronald D. Moore from Battlestar Galactica, and you're listening to Technorama.
Now, Chuck, we've walked around pretty much the complete circle of the upper deck of this building, and as I look out, I see a mirror on a post. It's got to be 5 or 6 feet in diameter and probably 30 feet, 40 feet off the ground. What is that all about?
Exactly. That's what they call a heliostat. And what that does is it's programmed to track every day, every hour, and every minute. It's following the sun's pattern here and focusing it through a big round hole that's in the front of our building.
Okay.
Up on the second level exhibit floor is going to be what they call Einstein's house, a study in physics. And what that does is it focuses that sunlight straight through the building and into this exhibit, which shows you how solar energy can heat, warm, and even power different objects in the exhibit.
So that, no matter what time of day or what time of year, that's always going to be reflecting to the same spot in the building?
Exactly. That's what the mirror does. It's actually built to track and angle the sun different parts of the season. So it's built and it's actually moving and tracking constantly until sunset. We know when sunset comes about because it actually twists up and flattens itself out and waits for sunrise, which time it heads out over the lake, picks up the sun again, and immediately directs that sunlight right through the portal in the front of the building.
I have to ask, what do you do on cloudy days?
Just watch the mirror.
Is it concave? Is it parabolic?
No, it's actually just flat. It doesn't focus. Okay. And it's a good thing because in some of the exhibit areas, while under construction, we actually put in some styrofoam foam board up there to block that area. It actually weakened and started melting a hole through it. So it doesn't need to be focused any more than it already is.
Interesting. More neat stuff around here. Now, Chuck, we walked back inside to like a reception hall, and you walked up to an AV rack and just disconnected like a little flat panel display. What have you got there?
This is called a Crestron. A lot of people are familiar with them as it's a wireless Crestron display that runs all of the electronics up here in the pilot house. The pilot house is a meeting space and corporate event space that we have. Again, 360 degrees of glass. Right now they're setting up for a wedding this evening, 250 people. But included in that, we actually designed the pilot house to be one of the premier meeting spaces in Wisconsin. And what I mean by that is the thought was when you go to a convention center, they might have the gear to set up, but we can support even more technology here in this building because we have an IT staff. So up in the ceiling, you can actually see 2 9-foot by 16-foot screens that come down, giving an unobstructed view, and then 2 high-definition Christie digital projectors.
Wow.
And we can run independent video on one or the other, or PowerPoints. We can sync them up to be the same. We can connect this area right here to the theaters down below or to the TV studio and pump things in. We can bring video in over Internet 2. Our building is actually on and connected to Internet 2.
Neat.
And so we can stream things like Bob Ballard's expedition here when he's out over the Titanic or in the Black Sea. We get a signal 7x24 from him, and we can show that live up in this space and in the other spaces. Additionally, if you were to come in and want to do a presentation, you could have your dinner guests here, but at the podium, we can actually, through a partnership with Sonic Foundry in Madison, Wisconsin, we have the equipment to actually take your presentation and show it on the web live in split screen. A split screen is live video of you doing the presentation. The other half of the screen is all your PowerPoint and video that's showing so that they're not looking at it through, you know, over your shoulder,
right,
but they're getting high-resolution slides. And then that actually gets wrapped up after you're done talking within about 5 or 10 minutes, and it's archived for people to come in and check later. We can actually work with VBrick, and we can stream. Now, usually, if we're going between Internet 2 sites, we'll stream up to 6 or 7 megabytes out of here into here, depending on what kind of presentation we have. So we have a lot of technology wrapped into this room right here, and we can put you live on the Internet. We can actually put you live uplink to satellite. If you've got the means to pay for a satellite link, we'll put you up on one.
When the Technorama satellite gets launched, I'll give you a call.
Exactly.
But it's very well done with the architecture, because other than the, you know, the projectors on the ceiling, you wouldn't know this all exists. I mean, it's just
right.
It's very well done.
Everything's embedded in the ceilings, as you can see the screens coming out right now. So they're relatively large screens.
So for a wedding, I can imagine they'll probably have a slideshow of the bride and the groom and family and whatnot.
Oh, slideshow. That's so passé. No. They bring in DVDs and videos now. You old man, Chuck. No, nobody has any slides. They haven't been shooting slides for years. Everybody's shooting movies now.
I walked into that one.
Well, now this is interesting because we're looking through the glass walls of an elevator. You can actually see out to outside. There's an elevator, but it's belt-driven.
Yes, it is. I'm sure that's probably the way they do it. Now, I'm not... sorry, folks, I'm not an elevator expert.
I've seen cables, I've seen pneumatics or hydraulics, but I can't say I've ever seen a belt-driven one. But then, again, how many times do you get to see an elevator shaft?
Exactly. You know, when they put the elevators in, they said, had they known it was going to be encased in glass, it would have put a nicer elevator in.
Probably,
but the chairman of the board, Mike Cuddy, he said, no, kids want to see this stuff work. So you can see the flywheels open and close the doors and all the parts and pieces moving.
Like a big toy set. But Chuck, we just went into, and now we're out of the digital theater. That was absolutely amazing.
Well, thanks. That is one of the only two high-definition digital theaters in the state of Wisconsin.
What is the resolution on that bad boy?
They're digital cinema projectors, and what that means is the resolution is 2K or 2048 pixels by 1080 tall.
On how large of a screen was that?
It's a 25-foot screen.
That is amazing. WL was just telling us, I want one of those for my home. That would be a little hard to get in your carry-on on the plane back to Malaysia.
I can always try.
Where did... There was a movie showing about corals narrated by David Attenborough, everybody's favorite nature scientist narrator. Where did that come from? Who produced that?
That's a BBC production, actually, and a lot of people may have seen Coral Reef. It's not a new movie. The difference is when you come down here to see it, you're going to see it in high definition. And that's, getting that source and feeding that theater is one of the more difficult things. But again, we can actually produce our own high def here. We have quite a book of science movies that we're running here in the theater during the day, whether it's Coral Reef or How to Build a Human, which is about the human genome and how we're determining some of those kind of things, or motion and physics, and even interstellar and planetary type of movies.
That was amazing. All digital. Digital projector, digital film. Digital source to projection. It's all digital?
All digital. There's absolutely no film, no tape, or media of the sort. It's actually digital. We have a QVIS server up in that room. It feeds those projectors, and really what it does is, the best thing about QVIS is that it can actually feed that kind of data and bit rate out to the projectors, because they do 16 million colors, of course, full bit depth, and then again the 2048. So they keep up with the motion. What's actually showing in there right now is running at, for those of you who are buffs about video and know all your resolutions, that's a 2K resolution, 2048, and it's running in a 30P or progressive frames. It's not interlaced, so it's actually running in a progressive. If we did interlace, you'd see the interlacing at that kind of size. So we have to modify the picture and be sure that we have all the frames. Everybody's going, how would you modify that? All right, here's a neat little techno wizard thing. What you end up doing, let's say you have an MPEG video or an interlaced video. You take it into Adobe Photoshop, and you create what they call frames. What frames does is it actually takes every frame at 30 per second you're seeing, and it generates them one by one. And if they're interlaced, it actually generates a full frame for you. Now you've got an entire hard drive, literally, of ordered TIFFs, and you can restack them into a progressive mode because we have full frames now. And so you can recompile them, resync the audio to it, and take your interlaced and make it into progressive.
Do you know how big the file is that generates that movie?
I'd have to go take a look. It's gigabytes.
And how long does that movie run?
That one right there runs, I believe, about 50 minutes.
Okay. 50 minutes, and we're talking gigabytes and gigabytes.
That's why you need the server, because as we put more and more on it, and we do have some of our own material we've been shooting with the Dennis Sullivan and its voyages down to the Tortugas. We're also in partnership with the local Milwaukee Public Television, which again is MATC, Milwaukee Area Technical College. And through them, of course, if anybody knows anything about high def, really, the leaders, the network that is the hands-down leader in high definition in this country is Public TV, bar none. They have the equipment, they have the expertise. And so a lot of the stuff that they've done about Milwaukee's history, or they've done specials about our boat and its voyages, are coming out now after two or three years of the programming. And we're able to show that on this screen.
That was amazing. The color, the clarity. I want one for home, too. Do you know what it costs?
I just come to work and use it. I don't have to buy one for home. bring in your surround sound disc and throw it in there and get it in 5.1. It's wonderful.
All right, let me round up the kids. I think they've gone back in to watch the movie.
This is Bob. Before, Bob relied on the internet to enhance his geek status. After using Technorama for natural geek enhancement, Bob is rolling his 20-sided die, reciting Holy Grail lines, and answering Star Trek trivia with the best of them. And he has a happy missus at the home, too. Technorama for natural geek enhancement. Only available at chuckchat.com.
This is Grant Imahara from Mythbusters, and Myth Confirmed, you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
All right, Chuck, where have you brought us? We're on board a ship, but it's suspended in midair.
Yes, you're currently on the full-scale replica of the Schooner Challenge. Schooner Challenge was the very first schooner built on the Great Lakes. It's 87 feet overall, and it's running right through the middle of the round building. And of course it is, as you walked in on the first floor, you actually walk below the hull looking up at it. Mm-hmm. And when you walk out on the second floor, you actually walk out onto the, you can walk out over the brow onto the boat and hear kids when the Dennis Sullivan, our sailing ship, is out of town. Kids can still experience what it's like to be on a boat, what it looks like to raise the sails, and the simple machines it takes for leverage to get the sails up, get the anchor weighed. And of course, in the background, you can hear the most favorite part, ringing the ship's bell. Which, by the way, if you do that on the real ship, you'll make the crew very nervous because sailors are all superstitious, and you never ring the ship's bell. So they can do it on here, but you'll just drive the captain nuts on the regular ship.
They've got a winch to raise and lower the anchor. They've got the beginnings of the mast with all the blocks and tackles to raise the sails. It almost feels like you're on board the ship.
Well, you are. It was actually built the exact same way as we built the Sullivan. The Sullivan was built right here on this site by over 1,000 volunteers, and tens of thousands of hours went into it. And how they built the Sullivan here, it was a parking lot. They actually brought trees in, and they cut all the timber and lumber to build the Sullivan, bent it, steamed it, glued it, and assembled it over a six-year period, and then set it sail. That was prior to us building this building here. And it's really the genesis for the project here on the lakefront. But the challenge, we didn't want to just put something together. We had the same people come back, and actually the same shipwright, and this has all been done the same way. It's all the wood's been manufactured for this boat. It's been glued. All the ribs have been put up, and everything is realistic to form except a couple of very large I-beams supporting it in the building, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But otherwise, the hull and the decking and everything else is done the same way.
Wow. So, realistically, this could potentially float.
Yes, actually, it could. It was seamed up. I don't think we sealed the seam, but we did caulk it and put it together. And that's part of the experiences for you to be able to see how the boat was built and analyze its design and build.
This is also fascinating from a wreck diver perspective. I've been shipwreck diving in the Great Lakes before, and this is very similar, aside from the cabin area in the back, which usually gets blown off when a ship sinks. But to look around and see many of the things here that I'm used to seeing underwater, you know, there's a winch. Well, the bell's usually gone, but if you're lucky, you see a mast, or at least a stump of a mast. Even a lot of the, you know, the woodwork around the decking is all still very similar, very familiar. Well, it's nice to see it painted.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're a diver, there's some of the things that we found when we built the Dennis Sullivan. that were very interesting. The reason why was because there hadn't been a tall ship or a lake schooner built in over 100 years when we built the Dennis Sullivan. And when we got it to sailing, we had a lot of different people and historians that would come aboard and take a look at her. And some of the things that we found, we had a musician, Lee Murdoch, who had come aboard a couple times, and he sang ship shanties. You know, the ones that were sung to get the crew in rhythm and raising sails. Shanties were also for turning the capstan to get the anchor up and raising lines. And he started using that on the Sullivan just to analyze them and started finding out that some of the songs that has traditionally been thought of as a sail-raising shanty mm-hmm. couldn't have been because the tempo was off or it awesome. Wouldn't work in the mechanics of the situation, whereas it had to be because of its tempo, it would have had to have been used on a capstan. And we're finding some of those kind of things. Additionally, when we built the Sullivan, we went with what we had for plans, insurance documents, because insurance adjusters would have documented the boats quite heavily back in the late 1800s. And a lot of questions come up as to, you know, why do all the lines come down next to the mast equally except the most aft one? Why did they always push that one farther forward or aft? And you could never understand it. Once you started sailing the Sullivan, you start understanding the tricks and the mechanics and the effects of the masts and the wind. And we even moved some of the lines and plates a year or two after building Sullivan to start understanding exactly why the old lake captains and the builders had built things exactly why they did. I mean, some of it just looks, why would they put it there? You ask that question until you build a boat and own one and have to sail it. You start then realizing, wow, that was a small bit of brilliance on their part for doing something.
It's like our job today, Chuck, in IT. If you don't provide documentation, no one's going to know what the heck was in your head.
Exactly. Always label.
They needed label makers and user documentation back in the 1800s.
Otherwise, spend good money on a toner, right? Lesson number one, you cannot tone fiber.
I thought lesson number one was don't untie the black ropes. Those are the ones that are tarred for climbing.
Exactly.
This is terrific. Lisa's busy taking pictures. We've come down the elevator in the round building one more time. And what have we found?
Well, currently we're below lake level and we're in our aquariums.
I see lots of aquariums. We actually, when the elevator got down to this level, the back of the elevator was looking right into one of them.
Right, exactly. It almost dips you right into the aquarium. So the back of the elevator is glass, and as you come down, you end up seeing the entire Great Lakes Aquarium, it's called, a 75,000-gallon aquarium, and the elevator comes down right into the back of it.
For a minute, I thought the elevator went too low. You said this building was built over the water. Oh, too far, too far.
Well, here's the interesting thing. We're not actually underneath the round building.
Oh, we're not?
The Aquatorium. No, we're actually between the street and the round building, the Aquatorium, and it's that whole grass area out front is actually a rooftop.
Okay.
And we have about 38 feet going below that rooftop or that ground level deck. And we're underneath that area right now.
Are these freshwater aquarium or saltwater?
They're both, along with brackish. And what they're actually doing is, as you walk through the pattern of aquariums, it's taking you on a journey, much like the Dennis Sullivan, our sailing ship, is taking right now, from the freshwater of Great Lakes up through the brackish waters of the St. Lawrence Seaway to the northeast coast along Boston, Maine and Boston, all the way down to the Florida Keys, and we have a Florida Keys team.
We're on a bit of a ramp coming down. Does that symbolize the different lake levels?
No, actually, it just is a ramp to get you from one level to another. You know, some things you're just trying to make way too technical, Chuck.
Helps the wheelchairs.
Exactly. But if you look, you can actually look through that ramp. They're all glass looking down into aquariums below.
That is pretty neat as you walk along this path and you're looking down on fish. I feel like I'm ice fishing or something. There's a flatfish. Is that a flounder or a sole or something?
Yep.
This is interesting. Nice aquariums.
Hey,
found? We found a console with a joystick and a knob.
All right, we're back to aquarium geek toys now. This is actually an aquarium with an underwater ROV.
Where is it?
See him back in the corner?
You know, oh, hot dog, there it is.
All right, and you can come right up to the control panel here. We can turn the knob, and it'll drop. It.
This looks just like one of those little camera deals they have on you know, the National Geographic shows.
Exactly.
Foot or two long.
It's a Sea Ray. Underwater ROV. We do use one exactly like this off the Dennis Sullivan in the lakes to show students the bottom of the lake, what kind of animals and life forms are down there. We throw it over the side. And in this tank, we let the kids actually play with it. And adults, believe it or not, a lot of adults playing with it. As you see, there's a large video screen over our heads so that everybody else can see what I'm doing.
Well, it's not on yet. But thanks to the wonders of taking a tour
technology
with IT Geek, he can turn it on for us.
Now, that explains something, too. Just for your listeners, a little secret, and hopefully by the time this hits the air, we'll still have our little experiment up. But you can actually stream this. So in other words, as kids are playing in this aquarium, we have put it on the internet as a live stream. And if you reach that stream, it'll open up your Internet Explorer and show the ROV and the kids running them into rocks and windows and everything else and investigating. So as you can see the picture right here, this is what you would see over the internet.
You're looking at part of a fake shipwreck. Is the cord long enough to come up and take a picture of yourself?
It is, actually. It's more or less if you have the talent to do such. I'm working on that right now. So turn on the light, and you can adjust the light. I'm bringing it up a few feet in the tank. Spinning it to the left, and let's
forward. Oh, I saw the window in front of us. Oops. We're getting some reflection from the internal.
Here, we'll get her yet.
Oh, at least you're gonna get a big flashy picture. That wasn't too bad.
I don't know how to turn off the flash.
All right, Chuck, we come back to the, what was this, the techno jungle?
The techno jungle, right.
Everybody's cleared out. We're after hours now, so it's a lot quieter, as you can probably tell from no background noise. And we are once again looking towards the art museum, which is also closed down. But you brought us up here to show us one final thing.
Yes, that's our Internet 2 connection. We have a very large broadband pipe coming into this building that we work with we develop applications and different resources to use the internet too. And we've been able to partner with Dr. Ballard and Tom Duchek, who was on your show last year. And through our partnership with them and working with them technically, we've been able to run ROVs over this IP link, even though the ROV is 60 feet underwater, out in the ocean, out in the Pacific Ocean, off of Monterey Bay. So we put in the Internet 2 link in, and because we're technically out over water, we're on a pier in Milwaukee, and nobody ever put the infrastructure in originally. What we've done is we put a 54 megabit Cisco wireless link on top of our roof, and we patch it up to the building you're looking just to the north. It's about 7 or 8 blocks away. It's called Cudahy Tower, and we broadcast up the Cudahy Tower and pick the signal up there and then rebroadcast off the top floor on the north side all the way back to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
Wow.
And then what we've done to expound on that is actually taken and put a panel antenna on the east side of that Cudahy Tower, and we can broadcast out over the lake. And we can reach Dennis Sullivan out as far as 17 miles. Our sailing vessel, the school ship, can be as far out as 17 miles and be reached and do broadband, Polycom, and VBrick streaming while they're doing studies with classes. They can deliver that. We've delivered classes from the Dennis Sullivan's deck into many classrooms in the state of Wisconsin and Midwest, Texas, and as far away as Pakistan.
That's really neat. Now, how are they getting the signal out there? You'd assume that with sails and things, an antenna would get blocked or You know, is weather a condition? What sort of challenges do you have with those, with getting the signal back to the tower we're looking at?
Absolutely. It's like any technical piece. You put it together, you have grand dreams of it working, and then you spend about a year to get it to work right. And thus, we call that the learning process. Yes, when we first put the mast, our first antenna was actually on the very top of the mast of the Dennis Sullivan. We thought we were doing real well because the Sullivan is a solid wood ship, so we shouldn't have a lot of metal interference or anything else. And we wanted to get as high off the water because of the reflection, signal reflection as possible. The Dennis Sullivan's masts are up in the 90-foot range, and it would take a crane to get it up there. And we put the antenna up there originally. Every time we would do something foolish and burn out an antenna or have to replace it, or they got hit by lightning once and it totally trashed our antenna and the electronics on board. We had to find a crane just to lift us up there to put a new antenna on. So we got smart. We brought it down in what they call the cross trees. This is an area where any really crazy IT guy that's worth his salt will actually imagine yourself climbing up the rigging of a tall ship while it's under sail. You're going 60, 70 feet up on a baseball bat that's swinging back and forth over waves, basically. And we can actually, now what we've done there, because we have the mast and the sails in a way, we've gone with diversity. We've put two antennas up, both sides of the cross trees, and that has solved that problem. Additionally, like you said, weather. Absolutely weather does. Humidity coming up and going down. Humidity seems to be the biggest factor in the wireless communications out to the ship. In the summer when we're doing it around here in Wisconsin, that's the most humid season. But still, we can get out quite a ways with it. Like I said, we can get out at least 10, 15 miles solidly and still have 3 megabits of throughput, which is more than enough to do distance learning on Polycom or Tambird-type systems. So,
Chuck, it has been a treat going around with you today, seeing all kinds of things that the normal tourist wouldn't see when they come here. I hope the listeners enjoyed it. It's just been terrific. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. And special thanks to Tom Ducek and Dr. Ballard for pointing in our direction. We're very proud of the facility. It's a wonderful place to come down and visit. And, of course, you know, we're not doing the natural, normal thing. We're kind of designing it. And just like we want to inspire in the community and the people that come into this building, a way to open up your minds and think and dream, we're doing the same thing in the IT department. Design it different. Try it. See what you get. Do something new. Think big.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chuck.
I'd like to thank our gracious host, Chuck Ullman, one more time, and thank you for joining us on this very special show. I know it was a bit longer than our normal format and even most of our specials, but I'm sure you'll agree it was worth it. If you have comments on this or any other episode of Technorama, you can reach us on the listener line in the U.S. at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. Or if you're outside the U.S., you can reach us on the Skype listener line by adding ChuckChat to your Skype buddy list. Skype is a free bit of software that makes calls over the internet available via Skype.com. You can also email us at technorama@chuckchat.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please remember to join us for a regular show and take a lighthearted look at the world of tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. There's sure a lot of it out there, and we look forward to bringing it to you. Technorama is a member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with Farpoint Media and a whole bunch of other great audio content at farpointmedia.net. If you've downloaded the show the manual way by clicking on the link on the website, there is a way to get it automatically delivered to you for free as it becomes available. We'd love to help you with that. If you're not familiar with how to subscribe, drop us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, a binary high five. 101.